This is David Christofferson, president of the Harvard Law School Forum. After graduating from law school, our speaker today entered private practice and at the age of 31 was appointed by President Reagan as the youngest U.S. attorney in the country. In that position, Asa Hutchinson garnered national and international attention for the successful negotiation of a tense three-day armed standoff between a paramilitary terrorist group and some 200 law enforcement officers. In the courtroom, Congressman Hutchinson has tried more than 100 jury trials covering a wide range of topics. But as we all know, his most important trial before triers of fact and law was before the U.S. Senate this winter, where he served as one of the House managers in the impeachment trial of President Clinton. During his presentations, Congressman Hutchinson was widely applauded by both sides for the preciseness and clarity of the obstruction of justice case he built against the president. USA Today noted that Democrats considered him the best legal mind on the House impeachment team, and the New York Times called his trial performance devastating to the president. Time magazine even speculated that had the other 12 managers been half as good, there might have been a conviction. Throughout the trial, it appeared to observers that Congressman Hutchinson was not motivated by vengeance or partisan gain. Indeed, hailing from the president's home state, his active role in the trial was seen as politically risky. Rather, Congressman Hutchinson seemed to have been motivated by his own personal convictions and belief in the rule of law. We are indeed very fortunate that he has found time in his busy schedule to share with us his thoughts on this most historic trial. His speech will be followed by a question and answer period, so we all ask that if you have alternate viewpoints to share, please wait until that time. Please join me in welcoming Congressman Asa Hutchinson. Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you for that generous welcome. Life, I suppose, is full of contrasts, ironies. As I look back when I went to law school at the University of Arkansas, each day after I finished my classes, I would rush to the boarding house where I stayed, where we had a TV, and I would watch the Judiciary Committee of the House of Representatives debate articles of impeachment on Richard Nixon. It was at that time that William Jefferson Clinton was a professor at the University of Arkansas, where I went to school, and where the rule of law throughout the nation was debated as to whether it was being upheld by the legal community. And so I never thought at that time, as I watched the Judiciary Committee proceedings, that I would ever be on that Judiciary Committee, particularly during an impeachment proceedings against the president. And then I also have to contrast trying a case before the United States Senate with some of the trials I've had. Whenever I got out of law school, I, like most small town lawyers, started trying cases in municipal court. And in Bentonville, Arkansas, we tried cases in municipal court in Bentonville at the fire station. And so every once in a while, our court proceedings were interrupted by the fire alarm. And that was a humble beginning. And many of my cases had humble origins, but I did wind up trying a lot of cases, being a United States attorney, prosecuting cases in court, enjoying and believing in the law. And many individuals my age, after practicing law for 20-some years, get frustrated with the law practice and want to leave, and they drift into politics. It was not so with me. I left the law practice with great regret, thinking I was really giving it up when I went to Congress, but I loved the law. And went to Congress, had great opportunities, but again, when I went to Congress, I never thought that I would go from the fire station in Bentonville to the United States Senate trying a case. I wanted to talk today about some lessons that perhaps we can take with us from the impeachment trial. Many of these lessons you might not agree with. Some of them you might agree with. But then at the end, I look forward to the questions and any comments that you might have. And I think, first of all, that I will confess that we did some things wrong. Wish we could do a few of the things over again. I don't think they would ultimately make any difference. But if I had to do it over again, I assure you I would think once more about that vote in which we released publicly the Starr Report. I think That, in hindsight, was not helpful to the process. Obviously, as Henry Hyatt has said, it would have been helpful to have witnesses on the House Judiciary Committee side. We did not anticipate the restraint on the Senate side, and so we were restrained on the House side, but that would have been helpful. So I'll start with those two expressions of regret before I move into some of the lessons. I think the first one is that the Constitution works. Many people, as we started this process, referred to this as being a constitutional crisis. And any time the Constitution provides for a procedure to follow, it should not be judged a crisis, but it should be judged a constitutional process or mechanism that we are following. And after the trial was over with, Senator Ted Kennedy made a comment, and he said that the real winner in all of this, in fact, I think he said the only winner in all of this, is the Constitution. And I agree with him, and I don't agree with him on everything. In fact, I tell my folks in Arkansas that I agreed with him on very many things. You wouldn't invite me home, but that's Arkansas politics. But Senator Kennedy was absolutely right. But I think you go back to the House side, and many people didn't want to pursue that constitutional process. They wanted every means to avoid it, and yet we believe that there was a commitment to it. That's what our Founding Fathers designed for, taking us through this traumatic time in our nation. And when it was over with, we can say that it worked, whether you agree or disagree with the outcome. And during the trial, I tried to make it clear in my presentations that I was consumed with the responsibility of making a presentation of a factual case to the United States Senate. I never felt a burden on my back as to what the outcome has to be or what the Senate should do, and I've never criticized for the Senate for what they have done in their result, because that was not a burden that I carried. But I do believe that because of the presentation that I made, that we made in the Senate, that we helped our country get through this time. The second lesson that I think that we can derive from this process is that the public has more confidence in the results if there is a bipartisan foundation for the process. And we're all partisans in Congress. We all have partisan differences. But when we can agree upon things, we ought to do that. And that was really my history of my first session in Congress as an entering freshman. It was my pleasure to work with Congressman Tom Allen of Maine, a Democrat, on a bipartisan campaign integrity act, reforming our campaign system, working across the aisle with the Democrats. So I was used to that. And so I went on the Judiciary Committee, and everything became a little bit partisan. I started having a breakfast meeting with Congressman Bill Delahunt of Massachusetts, Congressman Tom Barrett of Wisconsin, Democrats, and a couple other Republicans, saying, are there some ways that we can reach an agreement on what we need to do? And I learned that unless the bipartisanship is leadership-driven, it doesn't go very far. Now, it was helpful to us that we were meeting with Republicans and Democrats, because I think it did diminish the partisan rancor through the committee hearings. It gave us an understanding of the other point of view to a larger extent. And so it was helpful, but it was a clear partisan difference that we had. But the key difference was that the Democrats, in the process that was developed, wanted a limitation on scope of the inquiry. And the Republicans said, well, you didn't have that in Watergate, and we shouldn't have it now. Well, we were right, perhaps, on a principle. But we were so close to the Democrats, we should have joined together, we should have accepted their proposal, and had a bipartisan vote for the process that we were going through. And that's a regret that I have, and that would have given the American public more confidence at the very beginning of that. And again, it would have ultimately worked out to a partisan difference, I'm convinced, but it would have helped. And on the Senate side, they did that. They worked across the aisle, Senator Locke and Senator Daschle, and worked out a bipartisan agreement on the process during the Senate trial. And there's been some commentary that that was the worst day for the White House. Whenever there was that bipartisan agreement on the process, because they were hoping for partisan division all along the way. Now, it cost something. When they reached that bipartisan consensus on the Senate side, we lost a lot from the trial manager standpoint, for having a legitimate trial. We had to go through all of these hoops to get to make our case for witnesses. On the Senate side, they came up with this process where we had 6 days of opening statements, followed by a question and answer period between the jurors and the prosecutors. And that's unusual. So it was an unusual trial process that they came up with in order to accomplish a bipartisan approach to it. And so it was at some cost. And you think about what we had to go through to get to the point of calling witnesses. We had to make the case that we should be able to depose witnesses. And of course, this is after they had had depositions and after they had had grand jury testimony previously. And then we had, after deposing them, we had to make the case to call the witnesses. And then when that wasn't allowed, we had to make the case to bring excerpts from the depositions. And so there were many hurdles to get over to get anywhere close to an ordinary trial proceeding. And so I do believe, though, that notwithstanding that negative, we have greater public confidence when there's a bipartisan foundation. The third lesson is, as I sort of already made the point, nothing beats a trial. Witnesses make the case, and that's whether you're trying a case in a circuit court, a district court, or the United States Senate. And we knew that we had a responsibility for changing public opinion. Everyone, every day, were citing the polls, what the public opinion polls were saying. And Abraham Lincoln made this statement, in this community, in our country, public sentiment is everything. With public sentiment, nothing can fail. Without it, nothing can succeed. Consequently, he who molds public sentiment goes deeper than he who enacts statutes or pronounces decisions. And we knew that in order to change votes in the Senate, we also had to change public opinion. The only way you're going to do that is not from listening to 13 Republican House managers. It would have to be from witnesses who are impacted by this process, who have been traumatized by these particular events. And you also contrast it by the viewing audience. When the House managers presented their case on the floor of the Senate, about 9 million Americans watched it. That was the viewing audience. When Monica Lewinsky went on Barbara Walters, it was 70 million. That is a humbling contrast. And yet, that is the kind of national attention that would have been needed in order to change public sentiment, in order to change votes in the Senate. The question has been asked many times, why did you proceed over in the Senate when you knew the votes were not there for a conviction? I've been asked that. I still get asked that every once in a while. And I thought about that a lot. And my answer to that is fourfold. One, what is the decision you make when you try a criminal case? And my conclusion was that you bring a case to a jury if a fair-minded, unbiased jury could find guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. That doesn't mean you're guaranteed conviction, but if you can say an unbiased jury could reach conviction, guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, then it's reasonable to bring that case forward. And I believe that under the facts of the case that we had, an unbiased jury would be able to find guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. And I think that was a standard that could be applied in this case when important public issues are at stake. Secondly, I always believed the votes would be there if the oath to do impartial justice that those senators not took orally, but walked down and signed with a signature. If they took that oath seriously, I believe that the facts were presented by witnesses, then it would change votes. Thirdly, it is an adversary system. It always amazed me when they would come to the House managers and say, why are you going forward? Because under my view of the adversary system, it is our duty, in order to achieve justice and to assure that the adversary system works, is to pursue the case diligently within the bounds of the law, and that's what we did. It was not our duty to stop. And fourthly, the Constitution provides that the trial in the Senate is a mandatory process. You shall try the case in the Senate. It was not optional, and so it was important that the design of our founding fathers be honored. And let me go back to the lessons that we learned from this process. I would say, and this is a personal observation, that the public responds to a principled stand. Why did I agree to become a manager? It was pointed out in the introduction that the fact that I'm from Arkansas, it does not necessarily make good political sense for me to be a manager. And how did I become one? I was in Chairman Hyde's office, and he says, "Asa, I'm going to make you a manager." Now, it's true, I could have rejected that responsibility. I could have said, no, that's bad for me politically in Arkansas. But I came to the United States Congress to make a difference, to handle the tough issues, to do something good for America. And there was not a more important matter for America to get behind them than was the impeachment trial in the United States Senate. And I could have sent my colleagues over there to do it, but I accepted that role because I viewed it as a responsibility that I could aid our country in. And secondly, I thought there were important principles involved. When I was sworn in as an attorney before Judge Enfield in Bentonville, Arkansas, I took an oath, and I took it seriously. When I was sworn in as United States Attorney by Federal District Judge Franklin Waters, I took that oath seriously. When I was sworn into the United States Congress to uphold the Constitution of the United States, I took that oath seriously. And so I believe there were principles involved of the Constitution, of equal justice, of fidelity to the law, and I believed I had a duty to go over and handle this. Everyone, the media and the public, had difficulty in understanding the basic idea that we as House managers were willing to put at risk our political good fortune of being in Congress, the respect of our peers, and the regard of history in order to stand for an idea, a principle that justice is important and equal justice and the truth are worth fighting for. We were going over there against 65-70%, seemed like 100% of the American will, in their expression through the polls. We were going over there with a Senate procedure that was not exactly helpful to the presentation of the case, and people would say, why are we doing that? And eventually, we started getting letters. I got 10,000 emails over a weekend. I was getting 500 letters a day from all across the United States, and it was remarkable as I finally had a chance to review this. And I'm going to share just a couple of comments and letters, not for any purpose other than to see that it's still possible in America to touch the heart of people who watch what goes on in the public in Washington, D.C. I had a letter from Tino Finch. "Dear Mr. Asa Hutchinson, I'm 8 years old and in the second grade at PS 183 in New York City. Thank you for all that you did in the impeachment. It was real important. Every night at bedtime prayers, my mother and my father tell me and my brother that we have to tell the truth. You and your friends were saying that telling the truth is really important, so I knew you were telling the truth about telling the truth too." He goes on and tells a story. Then it says, "When I am older and it's hard to tell the truth, I will think of my mother and my father, but now I will think of you and your friends too. As my father says, you and your friends fought hard for the truth and set a good example. I will remember my brother too." Tino Finch. And adds a P.S. "Oh yeah, and I almost forgot. I sent you a copy of my class picture so you can see what I look like. I know what you look like." Then I had another letter. It does not identify the age, but, "Dear Representative Hutchinson, for a young person like me who is striving to compete and to excel in a turbulent world that is sorely lacking outstanding role models, my life changed dramatically after seeing you in the Senate trial. You taught me how to fight for what I want with grace, diligence, I like this part, cool precision. I will carry that with me the rest of my life." And I share those letters with you, and that was obviously from a young person, Tiffany Soder. And I share that with you because as you leave law school, you have an impact to change the world that you live in. And I did it in a small way in Arkansas. I believe you can do that practicing law. And I believed in public life, and so I ran for office. And I lost, some people compare me to Abraham Lincoln, only because I lost almost as many political races as he did. I lost 4 races before I was elected to the United States Congress. But I was committed to public service. And in fact, when I had the opportunity to run for Congress, I was running for state representative. But I was doing this because I believed you can make a difference. And I go to Congress, and I'm one out of 435. And all of a sudden, because of coincidences of life, providence, if you will, I find myself having a unique opportunity to help our country, and you can see from these letters, impact people's lives and touch people's heart because you stand for principle. Now let me just touch on a matter of policy, and then I'm going to conclude with this. And the final lesson is that the independent counsel law is flawed. Now, why do I say that? It's not because of what has happened with Kenneth Starr, but it is because of what has happened through the course of Mr. Walsh, all of the 20-year history with the independent counsel law, and the multitude of independent counsels we've had. I believe that we've seen a lack of accountability. It's been demonstrated that their independent counsel can be too narrowly focused in the pursuit of a case. We can see that they're politically vulnerable. The independent counsel is out there subject to attack, and there's no one there to defend them. They're out there all alone, and as prosecutors know, you can't call a news conference and defend yourself very well. And then finally, there is an overlap that we can see with Congress that muddies the water between the legislative role and the executive branch role for investigations. And so I think there's a problem with the independent counsel law. It is up for renewal. I do not believe that it will be renewed. And there are other ideas as to what to do when a conflict exists, because we can do away with the independent counsel law. It's not going to change the fact that from time to time you're going to have administrations that need to be investigated for wrongdoing. And so what procedure do you use? If we do away with the independent counsel law, we go back to the inherent power of the Attorney General to appoint a special counsel, a special prosecutor, such as happened with Leon Jaworski, such as happened with Robert Fisk. And it works fairly well, but I think that it can be strengthened. And there's been some suggestions. One is that we put the responsibility for prosecuting administration officials in the public integrity section of the Department of Justice. I think that's a bad approach because it is too akin to a permanent independent counsel, because that is their one responsibility, that is all they do. Another suggestion, which is made by Common Cause, is that you put the authority to prosecute administration officials in the responsibility of the Assistant Attorney General of the Criminal Division. And that's not a bad idea, because they have a lot of cases they handle. They have a broad overview and responsibility for enforcement of the criminal law across the board. And so you avoid the narrowly focused argument. But you still have the difficulty of that person is a presidential appointee, and you're going to have an inherent conflict. And there's going to be times that person will not be appropriate to handle an investigation, particularly of the president. And so I would offer a special counsel enhancement act, as I would describe it, which I intend to offer, which gives the authority to the Attorney General to appoint a special counsel, as is the inherent authority now. But it would also give a role of Congress to, as we have now, where we can ask the Attorney General to appoint a special counsel, and they have 30 days to formally respond and state the reason why that might not happen and why they do not believe a conflict exists. The third aspect of it would be to take the good part of the independent counsel law, and that is that the independent counsel cannot be removed except for cause, and put that in the event a special counsel is appointed, they cannot be removed except for cause. And finally, I think that you need to relax some of the post-employment conflict rules, so it's easier to recruit someone to come in to be a special counsel under those difficult circumstances and serve our country. And so I hope that we'll be able not just to let the independent counsel law drop, but that we'll also move toward enhancing the special counsel provision to deal with the conflicts when they inevitably will happen. Let me just say in closing that, and I use this in my closing argument to the Senate, John F. Kennedy wrote the book Profiles in Courage, and one of the individuals that he profiled was Edmund G. Ross, the senator from Kansas who, during the Andrew Johnson impeachment trial, went against public opinion, went against all the pressures of the polls and public sentiment and the threats that he will lose his political life. He went against that public opinion to follow the facts and the law. And he voted to acquit Andrew Johnson on a case that was not supported by the facts and the law. And I asked the United States Senate, 150 years later, the same question. Will this Senate have the courage to go against public opinion and public pressures and to follow the facts and the law? What would our founding fathers say about what happened in the United States Senate? I think another question is, what would Edmund G. Ross say about what happened in the United States Senate? I told the Senate that I would never criticize them for the outcome, and I don't intend to do that, because that was a heavy responsibility they had. But I believe that we presented the facts, we demonstrated the law, and that because we showed a commitment to the process and the standards of the Constitution, that our country is better off because we had our day in court. And a day in court is a cleansing effect on our society, and we can close that chapter, we can move on, as we have done in this country. Thank you. I've never been here before, so I don't know what I do now. Yes. Well, when I say I'm not going to quibble with the Senate on the outcome, I believe that there was agreement in the Senate that the House managers made the case on the facts and the law. Now, that doesn't mean that it mandates removal. That's the decision that's up to them. But when you look at 50 senators voting for the obstruction of justice article, you combine those 50 senators with the, I believe it is 20 or 25 Democrats who signed on to the censure resolution, which recited that the president impeded the administration of justice. That gives you 70 to 75 who agreed that this president, under my reading of the law, obstructed justice. And so I think the facts and that case was made. Now, that doesn't mean that I'm right or they're right on whether he should be removed or not. That's a tough call. But I believe that we proved our case, and I believe the senators agree we proved our case on the obstruction of justice. The censure resolution also said that that he made false statements under oath, and so you could make the same argument on the perjury charge. But the obstruction of justice, the facts, I do believe, were established to the satisfaction of the Senate. But the removal was a heavy burden. And there's a lot of, I mean, Senator Bob Byrd's a good example of that. I mean, he said it's a high crime and misdemeanor. He said the facts were proven, but he wasn't going to vote to remove. And that's a tough call that I will not criticize him for. Well, we need to talk about it more, and you should expect to hear much more about that. There was a bipartisan House committee, special committee, Norman Dix, the Democrat, and Chris Cox, the Republican, released a classified report, and so that's not much of a release when it's classified, but they came up with their findings and conclusions. That was done on a bipartisan basis, and it operated well, and it looked into the Chinese espionage, the impact on our national security and our interest. And I'm going to work to make as much of that public as we can so the public will be aware of that. Now, it's a little bit different. This most recent Los Alamos laboratory discovery of espionage going on there. Now, that is going to be investigated. We'll have oversight hearings on that and try to determine why it happened, as well as whether this administration took the appropriate steps. Now, I would not expect anything to be... we need to have more public discussion of it. Now, as far as investigating the president aspect of that, I don't think that we're going to pursue that unless it's done on a bipartisan fashion and foundation, as I talked very early in my remarks. Yes, sir. Well, there's a role for Congress. See, what was the president's famous statement? We're still relevant. Well, it goes in cycles. First of all, after Watergate, you had an assertion of congressional responsibilities and oversight, and so Congress is really enforced its role vigorously since Watergate. Now, I think you see once again the presidency arising back again. I think you can debate whether it's been weakened under this administration. I think I would make that case. But ultimately, the media power and influence of the president is extraordinarily difficult to compete against, and he has all the advantages. From a policy standpoint, Congress has a greater ability to assert itself, and I think that we have been very aggressive, and I think you'll see us more aggressive in that regard. For example, the first time in my recollection, Congress debated a peacekeeping move that was advocated by the president before it happened. You know, we took the initiative of debating Kosovo and the president's desire to send 4,000 troops in a peacekeeping effort over there before the commitment was made. And so we're trying to assert ourselves in that regard. Now, I think it makes a difference, and obviously from a legislative standpoint, I think we still control the purse strings. Yes. I'm still going through my stack of mail to see if his letter is there. Actually, and I haven't said this before, it was rather tense. There's a tradition in the House that the delegation, the members from the president's home state, comprise the escort committee to escort the president in for the State of the Union address. So this year, you know what was going on? I mean, last year was a little awkward because it was right after the Monica story broke. I mean, like 2 days after that. And this year, it was the middle of the impeachment trial. I mean, right in the middle of it. We adjourned the trial in the Senate, came over, and I had to go out and to greet the president and escort him into the House chambers. And so it was a little awkward. And so I shook hands with the president. I thought a lot about what I was going to say. And I said, well, I'm glad you finally got a decent defense attorney with Dale Bumpers from Arkansas. And actually, he joked, laughed about that. But Arkansas is a small state. We all know each other. And it's not personal in any way. It's just a matter of accountability. But thanks for the question.
Coming out of law school in 96, myself and several friends went to out to D.C. to talk to the House Government Report and Oversight Committee about being research attorneys. And actually, a couple of them did it. They were amazed by the incompetent management of that whole investigation. And I'm wondering whether or not you felt all of the local investigations that preceded the Judiciary Committee's hearings, whether that so polluted the well that you could never possibly have a fair investigation once we reached the proceeding.
You talk about the investigation from government reform and oversight, or start?
Whether the past investigations were just so horribly managed that the public was just skewed against the investigation?
I think that had an impact. The partisan nature of the investigation and government reform and oversight, the Burton Committee, had an impact on the public's attitude, because at this, whenever we got the Starr report, the public was becoming immune and tired of investigations, because the Starr investigation had been going on for so long. I recall, when I came to Congress, he was looking at Whitewater, and we were expecting at some point in time a report on that, which we still do not have. And so that did have an impact on the inoculating of the American public. But secondly, you look at, you're talking about an incompetent staff. Our staff was terrific. They worked extraordinary hours. But it's just not the same when you're dealing with political entities versus a law firm. And whenever we found out that we were prohibited under the Senate rules from using our majority counsel to present the case, that we had to do it. And we'd all looked around to each other who are House managers, and I had more recent trial experience than anyone. I had a lot of trial experience. But old Jim Sensenbrenner popped up, and he's been in Congress over 20 years, hadn't tried a case in 20 years, and the only cases he handled were uncontested divorce cases. And he said the last one of those he handled, he lost. So, don't try a case with 13 managers. It's too many. And it's just an awkward procedure that we had. It's difficult when you're using members of Congress who are political entities handling a legal case. It's the way it is, and I'm glad for it, because I had a great opportunity to practice law in the Senate. But things do not go perfectly, even when you have a lot of resources. And I think that's what happened on government reform and oversight. It did become partisan. You didn't have that good foundation, and it spilled a little bit over in Judiciary Committee. I don't know who's next. If you haven't asked a question yet, go ahead, right there. I'm pointing to you. Right there. I'm a little crooked there. Well, and the whole idea of the three-judge panel, and that's the one unique thing about the independent counsel law. The Attorney General still has to trigger it and ask for the appointment of independent counsel. It's just that would be done by the three-judge panel. But the difficulty is that whenever that person is appointed, there's no one to protect it. There's no mother superior over the independent counsel. Out there all alone, subject to political attacks, and quite frankly, I think this administration figured it out, that you spoil and you ruin the reputation of the independent counsel, whether it's legitimate or not. You attack the independent counsel, and they're defenseless, and then it destroys their credibility. That's one negative about it. And so if you do away with that law, then you come back, and it would be the Attorney General. That would be the main distinction. The Attorney General would make the appointment, and certainly it's not ideal. There's still conflict there, but it worked well for hundreds of years in our society. The Teapot Dome scandal was investigated by a special prosecutor appointed by the Attorney General. Watergate, in fact, worked well because the Attorney General made the appointment of Archibald Cox, who was doing an outstanding job, so the appointment was fine. It's just that the President said, fire him. Now, when that happened, public sentiment arose overnight and forced the Attorney General to appoint Leon Jaworski, who did a terrific job. And so, in essence, that procedure worked well, too. And so I think the Attorney General making the appointment will work. But the difference is that if the Attorney General makes a bad appointment, who's going to be held responsible? It will be the Attorney General. So there's pressure on the Attorney General to do it right, to make sure someone is independent and not to interfere with them. And so I think that will be helpful. Yes, and for whatever reason, she stayed on, and she didn't appoint very many independent counsels after that. To me, the Attorney General's office has been politicized during the last two or three years to a large extent. I've been disappointed in many of their decisions that have been made. But notwithstanding that, I think that you can't make policy based upon personalities. It would be wrong to make a decision on the independent counsel law based upon your view of Kenneth Starr. You've got to take the whole view, and the same thing for where you're going to put the responsibility for a special prosecutor. It's the inherent power and responsibility of the Attorney General. Let's leave it there. Let's have some role of Congress, put a little pressure there when need be, hold her or him accountable, whoever that Attorney General might be. And I think that system can work well over on this side. Whoever here.
You wish you investigated one of the Broderick allegations more fully prior to their appearance on NBC News. Do you think it would make a difference? Around here, certainly, I think, this isn't a community very receptive to your action about the thing, but to talk to people around here, would have been much more receptive to an allegation of rape and more serious charge.
Well, I think those who view that way ought to march down to Washington, D.C., and protest like they did on a few other instances in our past history. I interviewed Juanita Broderick. I'm one of these trial lawyers that think you ought to talk to witnesses. Whenever I was just dumbfounded whenever Kenneth Starr, who I have a high regard for, but he came into the Judiciary Committee and said that he had never talked to any of the witnesses. This is a case of a lifetime. And so, I, believe it or not, talked to Monica Lewinsky. I talked to Vernon Jordan's attorney. And this is just simply getting ready for, the Senate trial. And so I was aware of the allegations of Juanita Broderick. It was over in the Ford building, and she's my constituent. She lives down the road from me, and so I went down to see her, and I visited with her. And we made the decision not to use that, one, because she was a reluctant witness. She didn't want to come forward. Secondly, it was not related to the articles of impeachment, and from an evidentiary standpoint, we could not get it in the Senate if they made an evidentiary ruling. Thirdly, it would have been politically a nightmare. You know what they would have said if we would have brought that forward? They don't have enough with the Starr report, and so they're going on a fishing expedition. They're bringing in this lady. It's a desperation tactic, and then we couldn't even get into evidence. And then fourthly, well, I don't remember the fourth point, but there was one. and so there were some practical problems that we really could not bring that forward. And I felt like, you mentioned Roger Clinton. I think the then governor appreciated the way I handled that because I handled it in a professional manner that did not go out of the way to embarrass the governor. In the same way, it would have been wrong for us to throw that out there when it would not be admissible into evidence, but it was highly prejudicial to the president. And so I just felt like, as a lawyer from a legal standpoint, I couldn't do that. Now, quite frankly, I was sort of hoping and praying that she would, make her, if she's going to do it, if it's going to come public, let it happen before the vote. But NBC News made the distinguished judgment that should be held until after the trial. And that's their editorial decision. But when I met with Juanita Broderick, she was meeting with me almost as a congressman that she did not want to have this out there public. She saw what happened to women who came forward with allegations against the president, and she didn't want that to happen to her. And so because of that reluctance, we made the decision that it was not something we could get into evidence, and we were not going to try to put it out there everywhere. Finally, she came forward only because it was starting to get in the tabloid press, and if it's going to get out in the tabloid press, you might as well bring it forward in a reasonable fashion. And then she brought it forward. I didn't mean to be flippant before, but there's been a huge reaction. What was the name of the senator that had some problems with the women's groups on the sexual... Packwood, that's right, Senator Packwood. I mean, he was driven out of the United States Senate because of women's groups who were upset about a public official engaged in that type of conduct and the allegations being made. And Juanita Broderick, who is very credible, has made her statement, and you just have to ask yourself, where is the reaction of the American people? Let's go back in the back there.
When you were speaking that this process and decision of the public will have implications and repercussions going forward, both legally and socially, what do you see from your point of view and your vantage point, what are the implications and repercussions going to be, both legally and socially?
Well, I'm probably too close to the fire to really get a good grasp on it, and I think you also need the perspective of some time to judge all of that completely. But I'll regard. Like I said, the country had its day in court on this issue, and whether you agree or disagree with the Senate, we finished it, it's over with, and I think that the rule of law was upheld by the fact that we went through the trial. And so I hope that the American people will say, reach the conclusion that no one is above the law in our country, that even the president, even though he was not convicted in the Senate, he was brought to the bar of justice in that fashion and was tried. And so our system worked, and I hope that that is the outcome. Secondly, I hope that a cultural outcome is that I was inspired during the Watergate proceedings. You know, you can make a difference. What happens in Washington affects our lives and affects our government, and I didn't want to have cynicism reign forever. And so that encouraged me to become involved, and I read some of these letters. I hope that there's a new generation of young people that will be more committed to the political process because of what they've seen through this. Now, I might be naive in that, but that is my hope. I'll leave it with that. Back in the back there. Yes, whenever we started out, I went up to the Chief Justice and I said, "Mr. Chief Justice, be easy on me. I haven't practiced law in a long time." And he says, "Don't worry, I haven't either." On the former point, as to whether there was any particular weakness in our case or the defense that maybe affected the outcome, the defense attorneys were outstanding. They did a great job. They were very competent attorneys, very professional about it. And they did their duty. I think a problem from our standpoint was the failure of the House to send over the article of impeachment on the civil deposition perjury. We were left with what everybody thought was the stronger, which is the criminal grand jury perjury. But it was convoluted in the question and answer. Most of it referred back to the civil deposition, and the most clear elements of perjury was in the civil deposition. And in my take on life, lying under oath in a civil deposition is just as significant as lying under oath in a criminal grand jury. And so I think that hurt us in the civil, in the prosecution of the case before the Senate. You know, beyond that, you know, I can point to a few things that we should have done differently, but by and large, it would not have changed the outcome unless we could have had a full trial with my ideal 14 witnesses. Then give me another shot at it. Okay, great.
Yes, ma'am. Former Clinton supporter, I want to say thank you so much on behalf of my family and my friends. And I really appreciated the professional job that you did on the Senate floor and in the House. But my question is, do you feel that anything should have been televised, or do you feel like it should have been all posted from the House on?
Very good question to end on. On the House side, I mean, we have an open society, and so we move in that direction. But I believe that we made a mistake in the release of the Starr report in the fashion in which we did it. And it was bipartisan. The Democrats and Republicans both voted to give the Judiciary Committee, told the Judiciary Committee to release it unless they specifically kept part of it closed. And that sort of gave us the presumption of release. But in hindsight, I think it just went too far into personal privacy areas that we should have avoided, and I regret that. I would have preferred that, whether it's the President's video or whether it's other information, that it would have been released as it would have been presented to the Judiciary Committee in evidentiary format. Then it should have been made public. One, it would have had a greater dramatic impact, and it would have been presented in the customary fashion that we do in courtrooms, and that's when it's released. So that's in hindsight. As far as the televised portion of it, no, I think that it certainly should have been televised to the actual hearings, both in the House and the Senate. And you can debate it one either way on the Senate side in regard to whether the deliberation should have been televised. I would lean toward the conclusion that they reached, which was that jury deliberation should be in private and not televised. And I think that's probably a good practice for the future. I think it just allows for open debate, even though it probably did not make any difference in the outcome here. And from what I hear, there are outstanding debates in closed session that I hope someday they will release to the public, because I think there was some very thoughtful debate that was made on the Senate. Thank you. Thank all of you tremendously.